Did everybody get a copy of the part two of the? Okay, yeah.
I read it, and you're not asking us to write a grand statement.
I'm just asking you to do what the question asked you to do. Just as long as you answer the question, you'll be fine. It's like, right, dear. I'm not asking you to even ponder the question of why the President of the United States would call you up out of the blue and ask you to write a memorandum of this sort. Just deal with it as best you can. And okay. I basically didn't get nearly as far at the lecture last time as I thought I would. Mainly because I just find this stuff so interesting. The whole vision that emerges from the study of the documents about what the Eisenhower strategy was and what its implications were and so on. It's just really fascinating. But let me remind you again that we're concerned with this question of why the 1954 system. The system embodied in the Paris Accords of October 1954 did not provide the basis for a stable international order. It's a puzzle, because in a sense, you think about it, it should have. You should have had peace in 1954 in Europe, which is, these European questions lie at the heart of the Cold War. Why should you have had peace? Because this system basically solves the two great problems that lie at the heart of European politics, the German problem and the Soviet problem. Left to themselves, there's a big problem there between Germany and Russia. Especially in the circumstances of the post-1945 period, where the Soviets are in effective occupation of half of pre-war German territory, and they've imposed this communist regime on East Germany and so on. This is something the Germans are deeply opposed to. They view it as a fundamental violation of their basic national rights. They have a very strong interest in changing that status quo. They can't do anything because they're too weak. As long as they're too weak, they can't pursue a truly revisionist policy aimed at the reunification of their country, the throwing out of the Soviets, maybe even further changes. But if Germany became strong, you would have a very sharp security dilemma. I mean, you have a security dilemma built into this whole situation. Both sides, both the Germans and the Soviets, would have a very strong offensive incentive to pursue very active offensive policies for purely defensive reasons. The Soviets, for purely defensive reasons, simply in order to hold on to what they have to be concerned with limiting German power, and that leads them to pursue or to contemplate at least what we would view as an aggressive policy, a policy of putting pressure on the West and Berlin and, you know, threatening military intervention in the event that the Germans cross the great threshold that would lead to a strong resurgence of German military power, namely the development of a German nuclear capability. But the Germans might want to do that for purely defensive reasons, because how else can they defend themselves against the Soviets? Well, you may say, well, they could rely on their allies, but would their allies really come to their aid in the event of a Soviet attack, if Allied intervention in such a war would mean the destruction of the homelands of those allies? You know, it's like that's a very big question. And if the Germans don't have real confidence in it, they would want to build a nuclear force of their own, under their own control, that could provide them with some rudiments of security. But anything they do just for the purpose of providing for their own security is bound to be viewed as a threat by other powers, and not illogically so. Right? So there's that basic problem. What's the solution to that problem? It's fundamental to understand that there is no purely European solution to the European security problem. It's only by the intervention of the United States that you could have a relatively stable system. This is such an important lesson to be drawn from the study of the 1950s. Right? Why? Because American power blunts the sharp edge of the security dilemma for both the Soviets and the Germans. American power serves to cushion each from the other. It means that you could have security for Germany without developing German power to such a point where Germany would inevitably pose a threat to Russia. Both security for Germany and security for Russia. The mere presence of the Soviet army in the heart of Europe means that the Germans are under threat and therefore are obliged to pursue a status quo-oriented policy. They have to pursue that policy simply by virtue of the fact that they're politically dependent on the Western powers for protection. They're dependent on the other West European countries, Britain and France most notably, but above all on the United States. It's the American presence that's essential to provide for German security, given this massive Soviet force right on their border. And if the Germans are dependent on us, they can't pursue a revisionist policy when the Americans are basically happy to live with the status quo, because we won't support it. And they know this, all right? Yeah? Why? Why should American presence be a threat to the Soviet Union? You would think that that was the case because you come to think of the Cold War as this gigantic conflict between East and West, and any position we have is necessarily a threat to them. But that's not the case. They know from the outset that we're not going to go to war to kick them out of Eastern Europe. We didn't do it. Even in this period of great American military strength, we didn't do it in 1945, right? They know that we're a status quo power, that we might not like it, but we're willing to live with a divided Europe. We're not a revisionist country. We're a status quo country in Europe. Germany is an entirely different kettle of fish. The Soviets have an interest in the maintenance of a system whereby Germany is contained in a structure dominated by American power. That Germany is inserted in the NATO system, so where German power is limited, and Germany is forced into dependence on the other Western powers, and especially the United States, for protection, and therefore locked into a status quo policy. That's to the interest of the Soviets. You say, well, what's the alternative? A unified communist Germany? The Americans withdraw, they take over all of Europe, and they could communize all of Europe and have a unified communist Germany. Well, after their experience with China, they don't want that. And they say these things in private, right, among themselves. We know this now after the end of the Cold War. I think it was the Soviet foreign minister during the Khrushchev period, Gromyko. He basically says, after our experience with a unified communist China, the last thing we want is a unified communist Germany. I mean, these are important points because most people come in with those sorts of conceptions. Oh, yeah, they're involved in this dispute with us. Any weakening of American power is good for them. Any withdrawal of American power from any part of the world is good for them. But these countries are far more sophisticated than that. And it's not an accident that they're more sophisticated. They're more sophisticated because they have a very strong political motivation to think in these power political terms. Their problem is not with the American presence and the NATO system. Their problem is Are the Americans going to live up to these arrangements? Are the Americans going to comply with the basic terms of the Paris Accords? If the Americans had been willing to do it, the Soviets would have been delighted to go along with it because it solved their basic security problem in the world, the control of German power. The problem was that it's the Americans that don't want to do it. And the Americans don't want to do it for motives that you have to admire. You know, Eisenhower says you want to treat your allies as grown-ups, as equals. You know, you don't want to kind of make them simply into your protectorate. You know, you don't want to kind of treat them as children. You know, they're perfectly capable of defending themselves. Any self-respecting country should want to be able to defend itself, should want to take control over its own destiny. We're not cut out for the imperial role, right? We're there. We want to help these people. We'll provide our protection to them during this period when they're coming together and pooling their forces and building up their power and becoming a third great power mass in world affairs, you know? But it shouldn't be forever. And, you know, it's like, what's the importance of this? Well, this is not just words. This is the basis for actual operational policy. Not obvious at the time, because this policy could not be pursued in a totally overt way, for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But the upshot of the policy was what was called nuclear sharing. It's funny how we're just such prisoners of language. Nuclear sharing means we're going to help our European allies, first the British, but then also the French, and smaller countries like the Dutch and so on, but even the West Germans, to acquire nuclear weapons under their own control, to have effective control over nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them. This is nuclear sharing. It's generous. The very term nuclear sharing has a very favorable connotation. We're sharing our most important asset with our allies. Right? The term nuclear sharing essentially disappears from discourse around 1960. During the 1960s, people start talking about the terrible problem of nuclear proliferation. It's the same thing. And there was a very brief period around 1960 when they actually used neutral language, and people talked about nuclear diffusion or the spread of nuclear weapons and so on. But basically, you go from this positive view of the spread of nuclear weapons, nuclear sharing, in the 1950s to this very negative thing that starts in the 1960s, proliferation is bad. You know, the very term proliferation implies this is bad. And that's the language that kind of entered into the discourse and we're still living with that today, right? But the Eisenhower philosophy obviously implied that the Europeans are going to have to be armed with nuclear weapons because otherwise how could they balance a Soviet power on their own? How could they stand up to a great nuclear power like the USSR armed only with conventional forces? They obviously couldn't. And it would be much, much easier for them to do this both politically and technologically and so on, if they pooled their resources and kind of came together politically and came together economically and so on and formed a bloc, not just a bunch of countries organized along the usual national lines, but a true pooling of sovereignty, a United States of Europe. Very important element in the Eisenhower philosophy. The Americans are big supporters of European unification. Not because we benefit from it economically, in trade terms, we're discriminated against. European unification means, among other things, a European common market. You know, low or no tariffs among themselves, for trade among themselves, and there's only an external tariff around the common market. But discrimination in favor of each other by definition means discrimination against outsiders, including the United States. Americans are aware of this. You know, no problem. You know, this is a small price to pay to achieve the great political goal of a unified Europe able to stand on its own and relieve the Americans of this enormous burden of having to provide for the defense of Western Europe. Right? Eisenhower wants to pull out the American troops. He wants the Europeans to provide for their own defense, ultimately, in the long run. And that implies helping them get nuclear weapons. Right? So that's the heart of the Eisenhower strategy. But there are these other taproots to the nuclear sharing policy that are very, very important because they account for the intensity with which this policy was pursued during the Eisenhower period. One of them is the strategy for the defense of Europe that was adopted by the NATO Council in December of 1954, just a few months after the Paris Accords. This is the document called MC48. I had begun discussing MC48 in the lecture last time, but it's so important and people know so little about it that I'm going to talk about it again it's at some length. MC48, it's a nuclear-based strategy. Well, in a sense, all strategies for the defense of Europe, all NATO strategies for the defense of Europe in the Cold War were ultimately based on the threat to use nuclear weapons. But MC48 placed heavier emphasis on nuclear weapons and on the threat of nuclear escalation than any strategy that NATO had adopted before or after. It was the high watermark. A reliance on nuclear weapons and NATO strategy. Because the basic idea was that there was one and only one way in which NATO Europe could be defended. Right? And that was through the, through the massive, concentrated, and above all, extremely, extremely rapid use of nuclear weapons, both strategically, that's to say against the Soviet military industrial base in the USSR itself, and in the theater, in Europe, Europe itself, where the fighting would be going on the ground. Okay? It's a strategy for the defense of Europe. It's not just a deterrent strategy by any means. Europe can actually be defended in the course of a war. Right. How is it supposed to work? Well, as soon as you're convinced that war is inevitable, you give the go code, and an all-out attack is launched against the Soviet homeland. And you basically neutralize the Soviet ability to conduct nuclear operations against you. You destroy their bombs and their bombers. And you destroy the whole military-industrial infrastructure that's capable of supplying the Soviet army in the field and of building more bombs and bombers. Right? You basically are wiping out their the basis of their military force in the Soviet homeland itself. But that in itself doesn't solve the problem of the defense of Europe because there are all these Soviet forces in Europe itself that you have to deal with. And how are you going to... And you have to deal with them for a certain relatively short period because if they're not going to be resupplied by new military material coming from Russia itself... those forces will simply wither on the vine. But for the time being, they'll be able to conduct military operations with the material that they've already acquired, that they're already armed with. And so you have to kind of deal with that. And the way of dealing with that is by developing a nuclear-armed covering force in Europe. you know, that can, that's geared to fighting a nuclear war on the ground. A new, and how would this help defend Western Europe if you have that kind of force? Well, for one thing, the enemy can't conduct offensive operations easily in a nuclear environment, because to conduct offensive operations, you have to concentrate your forces, and when you concentrate your forces, they become an easy target for tactical air attack, air atomic strikes in the theater. And so the NATO studies, the studies that were conducted at NATO headquarters under the guidance of General Gunther, the NATO commander that Eisenhower had put in place there after he took over as president in 1953, these NATO studies reached the conclusion that, yes, this would be effective. Europe could be protected. Europe would not be devastated by enemy air strikes and enemy atomic attacks, right? But this was conditional on a number of things. One of which was that the attack be conducted in great force against all these targets, both the enemy's logistical system in Europe itself, stockpiles of material, transport facilities, and all that kind of thing, and against the basis of Soviet power in the USSR proper. The attack would have to be massive, concentrated in time, and very rapid. And that emphasis on rapidity is extremely important. Why does it have to be rapid? Because once these forces get in the air, it's going to be very hard to kind of shoot them down. The bombers are most vulnerable when they're still on the ground, and when they can be hit on the airfields itself. And to hit them on the airfields, excuse me, you have to move very fast. You can't allow the enemy time to prepare for your attack, because if the enemy gets that time, your attack is going to be a lot less effective. Okay. So that's what the strategy itself provided for. And that strategy had certain major implications. These implications are not part of the strategy. They flowed from the strategy. And it's important to distinguish between the strategy itself and the implications of the strategy. Three big implications: preemption, predelegation, and nuclear sharing. Preemption. What do we mean by preemption? It simply means going first. Getting the jump on the adversary. As soon as you're convinced that war is inevitable, then you attack. You don't necessarily wait for the adversary to strike you. So, as a matter of fact, Eisenhower recognized how important it was to make sure that the adversary did not go first, that we did not wait for the adversary to attack. We're no longer in a nice pre-World War I sort of world of countries delivering formal declarations of war through their ambassadors and so on. With survival on the line, you can't afford to go through such diplomatic niceties. Why was preemption so important? Because a nuclear-based strategy was viable only if you can guarantee that your own cities wouldn't be destroyed. And the only way you could guarantee that your own cities were destroyed was by destroying the enemy's forces to deliver the attack against your own cities. Because if you're going to use nuclear weapons against your enemy, and your enemy has anything left over in the way of nuclear forces after you attack him, he's going to use those nuclear forces to retaliate against you. Everyone understands that. So the only way in which we could have a strategy based so heavily on nuclear weapons and on the threat of a nuclear attack is to make sure that the enemy can't retaliate. Otherwise, the strategy would be suicide. And it was clear at the time that if we struck hard, and if we struck first, and if we struck fast enough and massively enough, we could destroy the enemy's ability to retaliate. We could neutralize the enemy's nuclear forces by destroying those forces on the ground. Okay? So if you had to move fast, who would make the decision? What are you going to do? Go to the NATO Council and talk this matter over, weigh the pros and cons of moving first, or, you know, with Portugal and Iceland and Luxembourg and all these countries, NATO allies would have a say. I mean, everyone understood that this was nonsense. You couldn't do it that way. And as a matter of fact, with time of the essence, with every minute counting, every minute could make the difference between, you know, success in the war and utter disaster that you would suffer. The decision had to be made by the person best able to see what was going on in terms of was the enemy preparing for attack. And this was the commanding general at NATO, the SACEUR, it's called, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. At this time, General Grunther. And then in the later Eisenhower period, it was General Norstedt. The authority to begin nuclear operations, effectively to start the war, was pre-delegated to SACEUR during the Eisenhower period. It wasn't assumed he was going to act entirely on his own. There would be consultations in the run-up to this period, especially with the American president and also with the British prime minister, the French prime minister. But the decision would be made by SACEUR. It was pre-delegated to him because of the need to act very, very quickly. The Europeans were willing to go along with this. You know why? In part, because it limited the power of the political authorities in Washington. It wasn't just the Europeans who were being deprived of the right to kind of press the button. The American president was sacrificing a certain degree of his authority as well. See? And the great European fear was, in the event of war, the American president would get cold feet. The American president wouldn't do it. But SACEUR, here is a man sitting at NATO headquarters, which at that time were outside of Paris in Fontainebleau. You know, day in, day out, every hour of every working day, SACEUR is thinking about this whole problem of how can Europe be defended? What would he do in the event of war? That's what his whole being was devoted to, right? And so if you want to have some confidence that the American government will actually order a nuclear attack in the event that Europe was threatened, well, you couldn't ask for anything better than the system. And in fact, both the British and the French accept this sort of arrangement with open eyes, these pre-delegation arrangements. The authority to commence nuclear operations is pre-delegated. We're not waiting for the enemy to attack. See, this is, we're not not even to start, ground operations, a conventional attack. As soon as it's clear that war is inevitable, you know, it's world, you know, the balloon goes up, the expression of the day, and the war begins. What they're doing here is they're capitalizing on this enormous American nuclear edge that had been built up during the Truman period, a result of the decisions, the rearmament decisions that were made in December of 1950. at the very end of the Truman period, late 1952, that the Americans had built up this edge. You remember that little chart I put on the blackboard? The United States is at the peak of its power now in 1954 and can actually pull off this thing. Europe can be defended. The Europeans will get off virtually scot-free. American homeland would not receive any nuclear attacks. Soviet Union, totally destroyed, totally devastated. But you had to adopt these rather extraordinary arrangements. In effect, you're accepting preemption. That's the implication of this strategy. You have to have these pre-delegation arrangements in order to be able to preempt effectively, to act very fast. But for our purposes, the most important consequence of the MC48 strategy is nuclear sharing. This is a world in which the only military forces that are going to count for anything are nuclear forces. Any country that doesn't have nuclear forces in the final analysis doesn't count for anything. Those forces are just worthless in the event of a real war. And so the implication of MC48, and the Western leaders are quite aware of this, is that all the NATO armies have to be geared in accordance with this strategy. In other words, armed with nuclear weapons, prepared to operate in a nuclear battlefield. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense when you think about it. This is a strategy, it violates democratic norms for these key decisions to be made not by the political leadership, but by generals, by the military authorities. Yeah. The rationale for doing that is you're thinking in kind of functional military terms. You have to remember, Eisenhower was a general. But if you're thinking in functional military terms, then you shouldn't make any difference between whether these forces, based on the nationality of the particular forces, the British forces, French forces, Dutch forces, American forces, German forces, they should all be armed on the basis of the same set of criteria. Plus, you're asking the Europeans to put their fate totally in your hands, and in fact, in the hands of an American general. Can you then turn around and say, yeah, well, we're asking you to place total reliance on us, but we don't trust you enough to allow you to develop nuclear weapons. You can't treat the allies like that. I mean, it's just inconsistent with the basic thrust of this sort of thinking. So nuclear sharing is, again, implicit in the strategy. It's a direct implication of the strategy. Strategy doesn't call for it textually, but it's clear that this is a consequence. Everyone has to be armed with nuclear weapons because any war is going to be a nuclear war. Okay. That's an important taproot of the nuclear sharing policy. But there's a third taproot, first being the Eisenhower concept of a freestanding Europe, the second being this MC48 business. And there's a third thing that also kind of points toward nuclear sharing. And this is people's realization that the kind of world that they're living in, where the Americans have this enormous edge in military power, especially nuclear power, that the Americans can contemplate this sort of first strike strategy, a strategy of placing very heavy reliance on nuclear weapons. It might be okay in 1954, but sooner or later, the Soviets are going to develop forces that could ride out an American attack, and enough of those forces will survive that they could go on and retaliate and inflict just absolutely enormous damage, not just on Western Europe, but on the United States itself. Sooner or later, they'll be able to do that. Why were people sure that sooner or later they'd be able to do it? Because what's called for by the MC48 strategy is an ability to totally neutralize, to totally wipe out the other side's retaliatory forces. That's a very hard thing to do when you're dealing with another great power, to have essentially 100% chance of success. You know, total neutralization of their forces. It's much, much easier in the long run to build a force such that some of that force will survive and be able to go on to retaliate against your enemy. That some weapons will survive, that some bombers will survive an enemy's attack, than to develop a force that can totally wipe out your adversary. Right? It's just, you know, retaliation on the part of some weapons is much easier than at first, than having a first strike capability that will totally prevent your adversary from retaliating at all. And so people are convinced that the other side is going to be able to do this, since this is like very different from the MC48 sort of thinking. Sooner or later, the Soviets would do it. People thought they would be able to do it a lot sooner than they in fact did. To anticipate a little bit, the Americans enjoy this nuclear edge, nuclear superiority, until mid-1963. It's only in September of 1963 that President Kennedy is briefed that those days are over. You know, we can't contemplate a strategy of this sort anymore, a preemptive strategy. Because no matter how hard we strike and how fast, enough of their weapons will survive that they can go on and just destroy the United States as a functioning society. But it takes them a long time to reach that point. And this was, and in fact, this was a big puzzle for the Americans who thought about these issues in the 1950s, especially over here in Santa Monica, the RAND Corporation. That's where a lot of this analysis was done. You know, it's like they knew that the Soviets had designed forces in such a way that they were absurdly vulnerable to American attack. They really facilitated our job. It's like, how could you understand this irrational behavior? And the answer was, to understand it, you had to kind of look inside how the Soviet system worked, and especially at the balance of bureaucratic power within the Soviet national security establishment, especially the great power that was still enjoyed by, air defense forces. But it was that sort of thinking, was what basically gave rise to the whole bureaucratic politics school within American political science. But that's a digression. The important thing is people know that the American nuclear superiority isn't going to last forever. And what that means is that a strategy based on the Americans taking the initiative in the event that Europe is attacked is not going to be viable in the long run. Everyone is going to start wondering. The Americans may say that they're going to commit suicide and start a third world war in which everyone will be destroyed, but that's totally irrational. As soon as the Soviets develop these kind of survivable retaliatory forces, the Americans will never go first with an all-out attack on the Soviet Union. See? And then, what about Europe? Europe will be vulnerable. You see? There's a big distinction made in strategic studies between what's called extended deterrence and direct deterrence. Extended deterrence means that a country like the United States could deter an attack, not just on our own homeland, but on our allies overseas, by threatening to escalate to the use of nuclear weapons. And it was understood from the start that extended deterrence implied a first strike sort of strategy. That, you know, you would, if you're going to escalate to the use of nuclear weapons, you really couldn't do that if the enemy could retaliate against you and destroy your city. So if you're going to do this at all, you had to kind of adopt a strategy which looked toward the virtually total neutralization of the enemy nuclear force. something that was becoming more and more difficult, and everyone kind of sensed that sooner or later this was going to be not be a viable strategy. Extended deterrence is very difficult in a world where both sides have survivable forces, because people are bound to doubt whether you would really escalate to the use of nuclear weapons if your opponent would respond by doing the same thing and directing his attacks against your own homeland. So people understood that as the Soviet force developed and became more survivable, the American strategy, which was based on extended deterrence, NATO strategy was based on the idea that the Americans would escalate, take the initiative in escalating in the event of an attack on Europe, it was becoming increasingly problematic. So what's the alternative to extended deterrence? It's, direct deterrence. Here, all you need is for the country that's being threatened with attack to have some nuclear weapons that are capable of surviving and that could conceivably go on to cause, extraordinary damage to the attacker's homeland. So if extended deterrence is wearing thin, you want to move toward direct deterrence. You want to help the Europeans develop the kind of forces that could provide the basis for an effective deterrent threat. So what's demanded for direct deterrence is much, much less than what's demanded for extended deterrence. Right? So they're pointing in the same direction. The Europeans should be armed with nuclear weapons. The Americans should help them acquire these things. And especially if they did it on a multinational basis, that would be great, because that would help build this kind of unified Europe. And the unified Europe could be an effective counterweight to the Soviets. The Americans wouldn't have to worry about this stuff. So again, it points in the same direction. And you look at all these things together, and it is not surprising to see that by the end of the Eisenhower period, the year 1960, the European allies, not just the British and the French, but the Germans, the Dutch, the Canadians, and so on, they were all armed with American nuclear weapons under their own effective control. Now you say, well, I never heard about this. This is quite extraordinary. Why did you not hear about it? Well, it was known at the time, but people attributed this stuff to the flabbiness of the Eisenhower administration, the military out of control, not knowing what they were doing, and so on. We know now, and it's very clear to me now, that this was a deliberate strategy. Why couldn't they be more direct about making it clear what they were doing? Well, the policy of nuclear sharing was illegal. It was a violation of American law, in the spirit of American law. We had this law, the Atomic Energy Act, that was passed in 1946. That basically said the president can't turn over American nuclear weapons to other countries, even to allied countries. Okay. A violation, by the way, of the arrangements that Roosevelt had worked out with the British during the war, because the project that produced the atomic bomb had a lot of British input into it. But that's a different story. Had this policy of helping the Europeans develop a nuclear capability, providing them with effective control of American nuclear weapons. The control was, it was understood that the kind of custody arrangements that the Americans had were just purely nominal, purely token. They were designed to be ineffective. Why couldn't they be open about this? The Atomic Energy Act said you couldn't do this sort of thing. Does this mean that Eisenhower was contemptuous of the law? No, he thought the Atomic Energy Act was unconstitutional. He thought it was a violation of the president's authority as commander-in-chief, and it also violated the basic constitutional principle of the separation of powers, because under the Atomic Energy Act, the Congress set up this committee, this joint committee on atomic energy, that got very deeply involved in the nuts and bolts of these issues, things that were traditionally the purview of the executive branch. So Eisenhower felt he had the right to do this. He couldn't go before the Congress and get them to change the law, because he was a minority president, Republican. The Congress was dominated by the Democrats. and the Democrats were actually more nationalistic than the Republicans in all of these matters in those days. So they did they did an end run around the Atomic Energy Act. They did this stuff by going in through the back door, by having de facto sharing, pretending that they were in compliance with the law, by having these purely nominal custody arrangements. And as I say, a lot of this stuff is known. Okay, why is this stuff so important for our purposes? Because if it's just the question of helping the British or even the French develop nuclear weapons, no problem for the Soviets. No problem for anybody, really. The only real problem was helping the Germans go this route. And the German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer very much wanted, for all these very understandable reasons, to acquire nuclear weapons. Didn't believe that ultimately the American nuclear guarantee would be effective because of the threat to the American homeland if the Americans ever did go nuclear. Therefore, for Germany to be a real country, it had to be able to defend itself. It had to be able to acquire its own nuclear capability. So the Germans certainly were willing to go that route, and Eisenhower was supportive of the idea that even the Germans should be helped to acquire a nuclear capability, preferably in conjunction with the other countries, but if necessarily on a national basis. Soviet reaction, well, what would you expect? They know everything that's going on, especially they know about the German nuclear aspirations. One of the things about this period is a divided country like Germany, divided city like Berlin, where it's very easy to go back and forth on the subway between the two parts of Berlin. It's very easy for the Soviets, using these communist East Germans, to plant agents within the West German government. These agents, have no trouble reporting what the situation is and so on. Soviets understand all this stuff. It was scarcely secret, anyway. And they want to head it off. And first, in the mid-50s, they try and head it off by coming up with all these plans for a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. They got the Polish foreign minister, his name is Rapotsky, to propose these plans. West is not interested in any of this stuff. And then the Soviets say, well, the soft line isn't working, so they turn to the hard line. And they lay on a crisis in November 1958. This is the Berlin crisis. When they don't like what's happening in Western Europe, especially West Germany, Berlin is the lever. Oh, did I say 48? I'm sorry, 58. I wrote it up very very fast this morning. Thank you. 58, November 58. I'll change it when I get back to my office. Yeah, this is the beginning of the great Berlin crisis. It begins in November 58 and climaxes with the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. Central episode of the Cold War. Right? Berlin is the lever the Soviets use. Right? It's the Berlin crisis, not about kicking the West out of Berlin. If they had wanted to do that, there were all kinds of easier and less risky ways for them to do it. The main thing that they could have interfered with was the civilian traffic between West Berlin and West Germany. If you cut off civilian traffic, which they had every right to do, and the Western powers had respected that right, West Berlin would wither on the vine, would not be a problem for the Soviets. But they're threatening the rights of the Western powers in West Berlin, their right to maintain a military presence there. They're threatening to liquidate the rights of the Western powers to be in Berlin. And if the Western powers try to enforce those rights using military force, the East Germans would resist and the Soviets would rise in defense of their East German ally. In other words, the Soviets were threatening the Western powers with war if they didn't acquiesce. But they said, but we'll give you 6 months to work this out, and so let's have negotiations. I mean, it's just basically a device to, as the Berlin blockade was in 1948, to force the West into the conference table and to kind of negotiate this thing. What's the proof that the German nuclear thing lay at the heart of this? It wasn't emphasized in the Soviet public pronouncements at that time, but you wouldn't expect them to, because a country that's the weaker of the two superpowers is not going to want to kind of publicize its vulnerabilities, its anxieties, and its concerns more than it absolutely has to. But you get you reach that conclusion by considering all the different possible alternatives, and ruling them out on the basis of the evidence. For example, the whole idea that the Soviets were concerned with the refugee flow from East Germany through West Berlin into the West. It was clear from the story. You just can deal with that just by sealing the border the way they did in 1961. That's what the East Germans are proposing to them. They don't want to do it. Basically, they say, we got bigger fish to fry. We want to keep this whole Berlin problem alive because we want to do it for larger purposes. Right? There's a lot of evidence, especially evidence that came out after the Cold War, that supports the view that it's this German nuclear business that really lies at the heart of the Berlin problem. The U.S. reaction? Not bellicose in the slightest. In fact, the American government is open to negotiations. But on these kind of core issues, it's just not prepared to give way. It makes it clear, in fact, that if push comes to shove, it will escalate, and indeed escalate to the level of nuclear war after a certain period of escalation, rather than give way in Berlin. There's no hope for negotiation. Last thing the Soviets want is a war. And so what happens is that for the balance of the Eisenhower period, the whole Berlin business is just put on the shelf, put on hold. And it's only after the change of administration in Washington in January of 61 and the coming to power of John F. Kennedy as President of the United States that the issue is heated up again by the Soviets. And it's that phase of the Berlin crisis that's absolutely crucial, because it's during that period, in the context of the Berlin crisis, that the elements of a political settlement are worked out. A settlement that this time will work. A settlement that this time will provide the basis for a viable international system. So let me stop there, and we'll begin with that stuff next time.